Hello, and welcome to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 28th of March 2020. My name is Steve and I edit and produce this programme. In the current coronavirus situation, we feel we can no longer safely use our studio and are now recording in our homes. So today, you will hear only two voices, Wendy's and my own. We're concerned for the safety not only of our listeners, but also of our volunteers, so we are no longer sending out our programmes on memory stick. However, this will resume when it is deemed safe to do so. The news and radio listings can be heard on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM from next week on Thursdays at 7 p.m. This longer version is available, as ever, on our website, sadtn.org.uk/listen, and on mobile devices via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free from iTunes or Google Play. Just search for Talking Newspaper. Once installed, select East of England from the list of locations, then scroll down until you find the two entries for St Albans. So, in this programme we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the current editions of the Hearts Advertiser and St Albans Review. We'll also have our selection of national radio highlights coming up in the next week, which will be read by John, a voice new to News Extra. We then have another interview in our series, Me and My Job, recorded earlier this year. This week's music is called Running Water's Full and is by Goffby. So now the news, and as you can imagine, there's a lot about the coronavirus pandemic. Here's Wendy.
United through the crisis. How can you help your communities amid the outbreak of coronavirus, which has left us with restrictions on our everyday lives? A number of groups have been formed in response to the crisis to deliver essentials and give company, via the telephone, to those who can't get out to the shops. In St Albans, Communities First has stepped up to organise volunteers and has created different categories for people to get involved. There are a number of ways you can get involved. You can become a shopping order taker, shopper order picker, digital champion, call handler, volunteer broker, postcard pat, dog walker, street champion, or befriender. The scheme, dubbed the Compassionate Connector Programme, has received 1,450 applications in 8 days, and the Communities First team have been busy getting in touch and organising those who have registered interest. To inquire about joining the Communities First scheme, please call 020-3940-4865 on weekdays between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. Meanwhile, the St Albans Business Improvement District have been working hard to ensure financial security from the government for the smaller and medium-sized businesses in the city. Permanent food market stalls will remain open in St Peter Street to allow people to continue to shop for essential items. However, Sunday markets will now close. Harpenden Cares was launched last Friday by the Town Council, also in response to the crisis. Its website will be launching on Friday, and its contact centre is being run by Harpenden Trust and will be manned from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Monday to Friday. Councillor Mary Maynard, who set up the Harpenden Group, said, "I have been blown away by the kindness and willingness to help of the people of Harpenden. We are very lucky to live in such a great community." A number of village organisations have come together in Wheathampstead to form Support for All. It will be collecting shopping and medication and providing telephone calls for the isolated and lonely, as well as help with groceries for those struggling to cope financially. If you need help in Wheathampstead, please call 01582 380 910. To volunteer with Support for All in Wheat Hampstead, please call 07539 176 481. Similarly, the Redbourn Care Group has formed, using the Village Hall as a community hub where volunteers are taking calls for help from people in self-isolation. They are also looking for volunteers to cover all of the roads in Redbourn. To find out more, please call 01582 794 550.
And now another story about volunteering during the current crisis. Volunteers needed to put communities first during the coronavirus crisis. Those wishing to help the vulnerable in St Albans during the coronavirus crisis are urged by the council leader to join a major scheme run by a voluntary agency. Councillor Chris White, leader of the St Albans and District Council, has highlighted the project run by Communities First, an organisation that supports charities and community groups. Communities First is looking for volunteers to help handle calls from vulnerable people, as well as collect and deliver shopping and provide digital services training. Councillor White, speaking at a meeting of the Council's Cabinet on Thursday last week, said, "It's great to see communities organising to look after their neighbours. I'm aware, though, that there is a rise in scams with criminals taking advantage of the situation, and there are dangers inherent in sharing details about vulnerable people. So I'd really urge people to think carefully about safety. Our partner, Communities First, has a well-organised scheme that people can sign up to if they want to volunteer to help. There will also be a need for dog walkers, postcard pals, telephone friends and street champions who will keep an eye on particular neighbourhoods." Chief Executive of Communities First, Stephen Craker, said, "We are pleased that the Council is supporting our endeavours to organise volunteers effectively during this public health emergency. We're anticipating that there will be a huge demand for help across the district from people struggling to get out of their homes because of age, disability or illness. By becoming a compassionate community connector, you can be confident that your work will be coordinated and directed towards those in real need. People who are being helped by our volunteers will have the assurance that appropriate safeguarding measures are in place." Councillor White also outlined to the Cabinet the Council's work to support the response to COVID-19. "The Council has cancelled non-essential committee meetings, and we are looking at safe ways of operating the essential ones. To inquire about joining the Communities First scheme, call 020-3940-4865 on weekdays between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m.
Hospital campaigner calls for disused buildings to be used to cope with pandemic. A hospital campaigner is calling on the West Hertfordshire Hospitals Trust to bring disused hospital buildings in Hemel Hempstead back into use during the coronavirus outbreak. Edith Glatter, chair of the Decorum Hospital Action Group, believes empty blocks on the site of the hospital could provide space for several hundred beds. Hemel Hempstead Hospital no longer offers acute inpatient hospital services to residents in West Hertfordshire or has its own A&E department. Edith has now written to Secretary of State Matt Hancock and NHS Chief Executive Simon Stevens, calling for the blocks and other unused hospital buildings across the country to be brought back into use. "There are many buildings that have been mothballed which could be brought back into use. There are several 100-bed spaces in two large blocks lying empty on the site of Hemel Hempstead Hospital. If the Chinese can build hospitals in 10 days, we should be able to bring all the closed wards back into use rapidly," she said. She acknowledges that the West Hearts Hospitals Trust, which runs Watford General, St Albans City and Hemel Hempstead Hospitals, would not be able to fund the work without support. She suggests tradesmen who are unable to work at present or the army could be deployed. Officials at the West Hertfordshire Hospitals Trust say there is not a shortage of beds across the Trust and the buildings at Hemel Hempstead are not being considered as a bed base for patient care at this time. The Trust has already announced that additional high-dependency beds and isolation facilities are being created at Watford General for those who have, or who are suspected of having, the virus. Surgical wards at St Albans City Hospital are being converted to cope with patients who do not need the additional facilities at Watford General, but who are not yet ready to go home. A spokesperson for the Trust said, "We have developed clear plans for managing the impact of COVID-19 locally. We are creating additional intensive care beds and providing refresher training on how to care for patients who require support with breathing. Our efforts are being given a huge boost thanks to Spire, Bushy. This offer of immediate support will greatly increase the staff and facilities at our disposal to meet the current challenges."
Traders will play a crucial role in supplying our food. St Albans businesses are key to keeping a healthy food supply chain locally, according to the city's Hospitality and Retail Association, which is calling for further government support to ensure maintenance of the local economy. Another letter has been sent to MP Daisy Cooper, who has been working to help protect St Albans businesses. The letter, signed by Sean Hughes and Mandy McNeil on behalf of the St Albans Hospitality and Independent Retailers, asks for cash injections for small businesses so they can continue to run. Mandy McNeil told the Hearts ad, "The St Albans Hospitality and Retail Association, formerly known as Save St Albans Pubs, currently has 80 members, with more joining, working in partnership with the BID, the Business Improvement District. We are all working together jointly, and it is district-wide, working with St Albans BID on a number of initiatives. While pubs and restaurants were instructed to close, the government relaxed planning rules so that they could immediately operate as takeaways or deliveries and will continue to be subject to applicable licensing laws. Our hospitality retail cafes and local artisans are key workers, as keeping a healthy local food supply chain is a priority to help cushion against the shocks and, frankly, help develop a microeconomy. Many of the businesses are operating as community hubs and cooking and delivering to the vulnerable in the community." Mandy added that the group's aim is to maintain a robust local supply chain whilst maintaining the healthy social distancing that the government has recommended. Last week, the government announced that it would pay 80% of employees' salaries up to £2,500 a month as a way of supporting businesses having to close amid the outbreak. The letter sent to Ms. Cooper added, "Closed businesses can't pay staff 100% up front with no cash. 80% reimbursement makes no sense either. That means businesses have to pick up 20% costs. Furthermore, most hospitality or retail businesses don't want to furlough employees. They want to make new business model click and deliver work and will need staff. The government is either supporting business or it's not."
Lockdown. Offenders will be dealt with firmly if they do not follow Boris Johnson's lockdown orders, Hearts Police have confirmed. County Police and Crime Commissioner David Lloyd is calling on the public to support his officers over the next few weeks. He said that the constabulary remains fully operational and prepared, and that the police have his backing to use their new powers if needed. He added, "These are powers that nobody wanted to take on, but the situation is grave and they are necessary to ensure that people are kept safe and that as few people die as possible. It is vital that we all take the government advice and ensure that the police never have to use their new powers in Hertfordshire. If people do not comply with this lockdown, the police will use their powers to enforce it. Policing is everybody's business, and that is also true of the threat we face today. It is only by working together as a community, acting responsibly, and being ready to offer help where it is needed, that we will overcome this crisis."
Milk Bank pleas for help for premature babies during pandemic. A Harpenden-based breast milk bank is calling for help to protect babies amid the coronavirus pandemic. The Human Milk Foundation was set up in 2017 by a group of parents, scientists, milk bank experts and doctors. It was born out of frustration at a lack of support for donor milk provision and countless stories of parents who wanted to access donor milk for their babies. Now they urgently need to raise awareness so that they can protect their most vulnerable premature babies, according to Hearts Milk Bank. Hearts Milk Bank, located at Rothamsted Research in West Common, is the UK's first independent non-profit service providing surplus breast milk to feed babies in need. During the COVID-19 crisis, they are having to scale up milk bank operations as hospital neonatal intensive care units are requiring more donor milk. The organisation needs to raise vital funds to be able to recruit more milk donors, increase the lab team hours to pasteurise more donor milk, and order more equipment to meet this new capacity. As suppliers to the NHS, they are classed as key workers and say they will be working harder than ever to support hospitals. Founder of Hearts Milk Bank, Dr. Natalie Schenker of Tavistock Avenue, said, "The whole team is working really hard to meet the increased demands from hospitals and to support other milk banks across the country. Vulnerable babies need access to donor milk, both for their own health and for their mothers to be supported as much as possible. Costs are increasing rapidly as the number of milk donors we are recruiting increases, and we need to bring in more stocks of supplies. The community has really rallied around to support us already, and we hope that this fundraising appeal will mean that we can hire more staff to keep the supply to all hospital NICUs going throughout the months to come." Dr. Schenker from St. Albans set up the bank with her friend Gillian Weaver, who lives in Dover. Last year they won a Points of Light Award, which recognises outstanding volunteers who are making changes in their community and inspire others.
This is a nice story. Pub customer puts his hand in his pocket to keep business afloat. As pubs continue to struggle during the ongoing coronavirus crisis, one generous customer has done his bit to help his boozer stay afloat. The Red Cow in Westfield Road, Harpenden, which is run by local company Far Brew, received a cash donation equivalent to what the gentleman would spend in a week there. He also enclosed a letter addressed to the team which read, "Bad news, I'm afraid. I'm 80. I have a heart impairment and I get short of breath very quickly. I suspect that most of those who have succumbed to coronavirus were in far worse shape than I am, and if all the over 80s in Harpenden were to contract the virus, I would expect to be among the survivors, but I am clearly within a vulnerable group, and it seems sensible to follow government advice and stay away. In order that this should not affect your cash flow, I enclose what I would normally have spent over the bar this week, and I will try to repeat this as long as I am absent from self-imposed choice. The notes are plastic, and I assume that they are washable. I hope you survive, and I look forward to returning when the emergency is over. It will be pleasant to meet face to face." A post on Far Brew's Facebook page said, "Possibly the nicest thing ever. Huge praise to our staff there, but ginormous praise to this total gent of a human. I've met him, and while he has also addressed it to me, I can take no credit. He is beautifully looked after by our staff, so all credit goes to them. These are dark times, but this rather overwhelmed us with loveliness. Thank you, sir. Thank you so very much." The pub swiftly sent him some beer to keep him going, and posts about his generosity received about 5,000 likes across their social media platforms. Far Brew co-owner Nick Farr said, "We at Far Brew were touched and delighted to receive this letter from one of our valued customers, a real example of community spirit. It's how we should all be approaching this devastating time for many industries, but none more so than hospitality. We are urging everyone to buy local, to support their community businesses, and hopefully we can see this through. A pub is a home from home for many. Please support them however you can."
Chamber responds to coronavirus crisis. St. Albans Chamber of Commerce has cancelled all of its events between now and the end of August and closed its office to visitors because of the coronavirus outbreak. Chamber President Alistair Woodgate made the announcement to members in a statement on Friday morning, following an emergency board meeting on Thursday. Events planned included the annual St George's Day lunch at Sotwell House, breakfast meetings, and the St Albans Business Festival. Some of these will be rescheduled for a later date after the end of the pandemic, and members will be encouraged to carry over their bookings to the revised time. He said, "The well-being of our members and employees is at the forefront of everything we do. The UK situation is changing daily. We will continue to adhere strictly to government, NHS and Public Health England advice, whilst remaining fully committed to providing an ongoing service to you, our members. You can continue to contact us by phone or email. We remain operational, albeit the Chamber office is now closed to visitors, and staff are able to work remotely as the need arises. All of our planned events between now and the end of August are regrettably being cancelled or deferred. We will be in touch with all sponsors and attendees early next week with additional information. However, we plan to provide information and activities online over the coming weeks so we can all keep in touch with each other. We will continue to help you where we can, with practical advice and support, as we all rise to the challenges that coronavirus presents. We are monitoring the situation closely, and we will keep you updated if there are any further changes." Alistair added, "On behalf of the Chamber directors and staff, I wish you all good health."
Commuter charges. A decision to scrap the congestion charge to support NHS and emergency workers in London during the coronavirus crisis has been welcomed by St Albans MP Daisy Cooper. She took action after being contacted by an NHS worker who lives in St Albans and works in London, who asked if there was anything she could do to suspend the congestion zone and parking fees for NHS and emergency workers. In response, Daisy wrote to the London Mayor Sadiq Khan to highlight how staff were incurring increasing personal costs as commuting becomes more difficult. The following day, the Mayor announced that all road user charging schemes in the capital would be suspended. Daisy added, "If I've helped make an otherwise completely horrible situation slightly less horrible for some frontline workers, then I'm taking that as a win."
Good neighbours. London Coney Parish Council has set up a Good Neighbours hotline after being inundated with volunteers hoping to support those in isolation. The Parish Council suspended activities, including weekly seated exercise classes and lunch clubs, to safeguard the community against the coronavirus. In response to people keen to offer help to their neighbours, the Council has today set up a Good Neighbours hotline, where those who need help or those who are offering support can pass their details to the Parish Council office. Parish Council Chair, Councillor Catherine Gardner, said, "We will be working with the churches, community groups and police to identify and offer support to all those residents who need the services of a good neighbour, whether it is delivering shopping, collecting a prescription, posting a letter, or whatever will make life a bit easier for them. For more information, contact Antonia Wingate on 01727 821 314.
Harpenden Estate purchase is put on hold as pandemic takes toll on property values. Controversial plans for St Albans Council to purchase the Harpenden Estate have been put on hold as the coronavirus outbreak impacts on property values. The Council had drawn up plans to invest around £18.75 million in shops, offices and residential properties around Harpenden High Street. And it was said the very long-term investment would allow the Council to take on a place-shaping role and bring in an income. But at a meeting of St Albans District Council's Cabinet last Thursday, March the 19th, it emerged the deal had been put on ice. Liberal Democrat Council Leader Councillor Chris White told the meeting that the impact of the coronavirus on property valuations had led to the Council putting the purchase on hold for now. He said that since the coronavirus restrictions had been announced by the government, leading property valuation firms had added material valuation uncertainty clauses to all future valuations. And that, he said, had created huge uncertainty around the value of the Harpenden estate and the risks associated. He stressed that the Harpenden estate remained the right property estate for the council. But he said the decision had been taken to pause the acquisition process until the property industry is able to assess property implications in a rational way. And at that time, he said, the council would re-engage with the vendor to conclude the acquisition. The plans have been surrounded in controversy for some time, and conservatives have already called for the purchase to be axed. Even before the outbreak of the coronavirus, critics had pointed to the relatively low return on the proposed investment. They highlighted the risks of falling rents, the decline of the high street, and erosion in the value of the capital. And they had questioned whether the council could actually implement some of the measures that had been suggested. After the meeting, Conservative group leader Councillor Mary Maynard again called for the project to be scrapped. The Harpenden estate decision was imprudent, even before the coronavirus pandemic. It would be reckless to go ahead with it. She said it is the wrong time for the council to become involved with retail and commercial property such as this.
Mum Maureen helps Malawian children through Mary's Meals charity. A St Albans mum has donated 60 filled backpacks to school children in Malawi. As part of this year's Mother's Day celebrations, school feeding charity, Mary's Meals, has been celebrating the incredible women who make this work possible. Retired mother of two, Maureen Renouf, has collected more than 60 backpacks filled with school essentials. The bags will be sent to classrooms in Malawi by Mary's Meals as part of the charity's backpack project. The 78-year-old enlisted the help of her daughter, Marisha, to fill second-hand backpacks with pencils, notepads and clothing. Donations from family and friends quickly overwhelmed her garage, and Maureen was able to fill 60 bags. Maureen said, "Taking part in the backpack project for Mary's Meals made me appreciate how many items we throw away that can be recycled. It gives me so much joy to know that children receive a meal in school and a backpack full of the things that they need for their lessons." Marisha said, "Mum's heart is pure love. She has spent her retirement helping others. She is such an inspiring woman." UK Executive Director of Mary's Meals, Daniel Adams, said, "Maureen's wonderful gifts to Mary Meals will ensure children in Malawi can get the most out of their education, giving them the chance of a better future." In more ways than one, mums make Mary's Meals. From loving volunteers who prepare the food to our dedicated supporters such as Maureen here in the UK, each and every little act of motherly love is cause for celebration. Mary's Meals feeds 1.6 million children every school day in 18 of the world's poorest countries. These nutritious meals attract children to the classroom, where they can receive an education that can be their route out of poverty. Items donated through the Backpack Project help to ensure these children can make the most of their time at school. The charity is asking supporters to send a Mother's Day gift card to their mum or someone special. Each card, priced at £15.90, will feed a hungry child for a whole school year with Mary's Meals.
Wilder St Albans initiative receives the green light. Things are getting wild across the district as part of a new project to improve wildlife and biodiversity. The Wilder St Albans project is the brainchild of St Albans Environment Action Group, an organisation of residents, councillors and interest groups that work alongside the council to achieve environmental change. The initiative will be run in conjunction with the Hearts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust, using a £100,000 grant for the next 2 years. The Wildlife Trust will compile a full audit of the district's habitats and species to form the basis of the Wilder St Albans plan. A Wilder St Albans project officer will be recruited to develop the plan and help community groups deliver projects which conserve and increase wildlife habitats. The projects will be promoted on a Wilder St Albans website, which will also become a forum for ideas and detail progress, and residents will be encouraged to get involved and put forward their own wilding schemes. Council leader, Councillor Chris White, portfolio holder for Climate and Environment, said, "To be successful, we will need the active support of our residents, and I'm pleased to say that a number of community groups have already approached us about taking part in wilding projects. Such projects can improve the look of our neighbourhoods, create better conditions for wildlife to flourish, and also help reduce the effect of CO2 emissions through carbon capture." This initiative, underpinned by substantial funding, shows how determined we are to better our environment and work with residents and partner organisations like the Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust to do so. Leslie Davies, Chief Executive of the Wildlife Trust, said, "We are looking forward to working with residents and community groups in the district, helping them to contribute to make the district a place where wildlife thrives." Green Councillor Simon Grover, one of the coordinators of the St Albans Environment Action Group, said, "It's fantastic that this exciting project has got the go-ahead. It will create countless opportunities for people to get involved in improving our environment and fighting the climate emergency. It will also bring together and promote the dozens of individual projects that people across the district are already involved in. The council is already working on a number of wilding initiatives across the district, including green roofs, tree planting, and the enhancement of the Quaker Garden in Victoria Street as part of the City Centre Opportunity Site South Development."
Sunday Times names St Albans as one of the UK's best places to live. St Albans is one of the best places to live in the UK, according to the Sunday Times. The city was named Best in the South East in the paper's Best Places to Live 2020 list, which was published on March 22nd. The paper described St Albans as a vibrant, independent city, sought after for its proximity to London, convenient transport links, and excellent schools. The place is thriving, with independent shops, bustling markets, a packed calendar of events, and one of the best pub cultures in the country, it said. The countryside on the doorstep is also a big draw, as is the sense of community and the smart centre, with the Grand Cathedral surrounded by streets of higgledy-piggledy buildings that date back to the Middle Ages. Beaumont, Sandringham and St Albans Girls' School all receive special mention for being amongst the 200 best state secondaries in the country, according to the Sunday Times Parent Power Guide. St Albans High School for Girls and St Albans School scored high in the private sector, coming 33rd and 80th respectively in the Parent Power Independent Secondary League table. In fact, the paper's only caveat was the city's slower pace of life compared to the capital. 24-hour convenience culture has not reached this leafy part of Hertfordshire, it said. Many restaurants close early during the week, and there are a few late-night options on Deliveroo. Bishop Stortford was the only other place in Hearts to make the 15-strong South East shortlist, whilst Altrincham in Greater Manchester was the overall winner.
This is the Daisy Cooper Westminster Diary. Parliament isn't designed to deal with crises, but it's amazing how quickly it can adapt when it wants to. On Monday the 16th, around 600 MPs had arrived in Westminster from around the country as usual. By the end of the day, all parliamentary staff had been instructed to work from home and all visitors were barred, with immediate effect. Parliament adapted quickly. Some MPs left London immediately. On Tuesday, opposition parties were invited to private sessions to ask questions of Number 10. By Wednesday, Prime Minister's questions were unrecognisable. Normally, MPs clamour to reserve their seats from 8 a.m. and then cram themselves onto the green benches like sardines. Not this week. MPs were instructed not to attend at all unless they had been guaranteed a slot to ask a question. By Thursday, most MPs had left Westminster. Those of us who were left, wanting to raise urgent issues, practised social distancing in the almost empty chamber. Number 10 adapted too. The demand for greater clarity on government decisions had become a clamour, so on Monday there was the first daily update from Downing Street. This has added to the changes for MPs. Each day, within minutes of the press conference ending, a wave of queries has filled my inbox. Every headline announcement raises more questions than it answers. The devil is always in the detail. My office has also had to adapt. On Wednesday, we introduced a new member of staff to the team, by video. With all these changes, a question has arisen. How will MPs vote? Normally, MPs stand shoulder to shoulder in corridors known as division lobbies and shuffle through narrow bottlenecks where clerks record our names and vote. Knowing that the government was going to publish controversial emergency legislation, some MPs asked whether we could use deferred divisions, where MPs vote on a series of proposals using ballot papers at a convenient time over a 2 to 3 hour period. A bit like polling day. Or better still, electronic voting, like Scotland and most other modern parliaments. As always happens when this type of modernisation is suggested, the suggestions seem to get lost amongst all the other issues, proving that Parliament can adapt, but only when it wants to.
Please give your support to local businesses. During this time of uncertainty and disruption, ensuring your friends and family have everything they need to get through weeks of self-isolation is crucial. From your regular groceries to special birthday presents, takeaway meals to bouquets of reassuring flowers, children's crafts to home gym equipment, it's never been easier to continue using our local retailers for all your shopping requirements. With pubs and restaurants shut for the duration of the pandemic, and independent retailers closing their doors to the public daily, it's also crucial that we offer whatever support we can to keep them in business throughout the coming months. Our much-loved pubs, restaurants and shops will struggle to survive if we stop using them and turn to national online organisations at this time of hardship. So, instead of buying from a chain or huge multinational delivery company, seek out details on how you can use your favourite local retailers for all of your shopping needs. It will keep them going through the crisis and ensure they are still there to greet you when things return to normal. Use your local shops from the comfort of your own couch. Browse their websites. Pick up a little treat to make you feel better in these dark days. We know that this is a difficult time for everyone, but people are still shopping and still eating. It's just about where you're spending your money. Many companies run an online business already, or have set up a delivery service in the past few days. Others have set up outdoor market stalls, or are working together to bring their produce to the public's doors. If more local people start supporting their efforts, we will all come through this intact. So our plea to you all is a simple one. Order a takeaway from your favourite restaurant. Buy your loved one a birthday gift from a local retailer. Keep the local economy going so that when this is all over, we still have high streets that are thriving. And now, the list of people whose deaths were announced in this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. John Bennett, aged 85 years. David Crampton. Daphne Thompson, aged 84. Joan Thornton, aged 85. And Arthur Wally Walker, aged 100. Now, some more of our musical offering, and then we'll have our selection of interesting national radio programmes for the coming week.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights. We'll start with Saturday, March 28th. And the afternoon drama on Radio 4 at 3pm is Jules Verne's sequel to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. It's entitled To the Ends of the Earth, The Mysterious Island. Three very different people escape the American Civil War by stealing a balloon, which crashes near a deserted island. But perhaps it's not quite as deserted as they think. Agatha Christie fans will be keen to tune into Radio 4 Extra at 4pm for the dramatisation of her 1961 murder mystery involving black magic, The Pale Horse. Then at 6:30pm on Radio 3, Opera on 3 presents Beethoven's only opera, Fidelio. Recorded earlier this month at London's Royal Opera House, soprano Lisa Davison plays Leonora, the devoted wife of Florestan, whose love for her wrongly imprisoned husband means she will stop at nothing to ensure his freedom. Finally, for Saturday, March 28th, and inevitably, there will be a number of programmes this week focusing on coronavirus, Archive on 4 looks at whether the 2019 election can really affect a radical redistribution of power and how COVID-19 might speed or slow that process. That's Archive on 4 at 8pm on Radio 4. Now for Sunday, March 29th. Always a pleasure to tune into Radio 4's Desert Island Discs, and the castaway is actor Brian Cox. That's 11:15 on Radio 4 in the morning and repeated on Friday, April 3rd at 9am. Then at 1:30pm on Radio 4 in The Ugly Truth, blind presenter Lyndall Bywater assesses the value society places on physical appearance, exploring this invisible force that controls how sighted people behave. It's repeated on Tuesday, March 31st at 11am. Still with Radio 4, drama at 3pm is Mike Walker's Castle of the Hawk. The year is 1618, and Wallerstein is a brilliant soldier who wants a career in the army of the Holy Roman Empire, but he just can't hold his tongue. Katerina, a widow, takes him under her wing, and with her guidance, he achieves great fame and fortune. Then over to Radio 3 at 7:30pm for more drama. The Moors of England. Set in the 16th century, Rex Urbano's play tells the story of Sir Robert Cecil and his black Muslim servant, Fortunatus, who takes drastic action to change the course of history. Finally, for Sunday, March 29th, at 11:30pm on Radio 3, is Slow Radio, If You Go Down to the Woods Tonight. Enjoy the relaxing nighttime soundscape of a woodland in Suffolk. A recording box placed in a tree captures a church clock striking the hour, owls hooting and all kinds of creatures scurrying past. Now a look at those programmes which are broadcast each day at the same time. Book of the Week at 9:45am each day on Radio 4 is Dickens' A Life. June marks the 150th anniversary of Charles Dickens' death, and here's another chance to hear Penelope Wilton's 2011 reading of Claire Tomalin's biography of the novelist. The story begins with his troubled childhood. Then, at 10:45am on Radio 4 each day, Ian McKellen reads William Wordsworth's great autobiographical work, The Prelude. Recorded at the poet's home in Cumbria's Grasmere, this first episode looks back at his early life. Composer of the Week at 12 noon each day on Radio 3 is Franz Schubert. Each programme also features one of his string quartets. The first episode is in 1813 when Schubert was a 16-year-old schoolboy who, much to his father's disappointment, was too distracted by music. Back to Radio 4 at 7:45pm for About Love. In celebration of the 160th anniversary of Anton Chekhov's death, Michael Pennington plays the great Russian writer, presenting a series of short stories on marriage. Finally, over to Radio 3 at 10:45pm each evening for the essay Paul Robeson in Five Songs. The turbulent life of the great American bass baritone singer, actor and civil rights activist is reflected in five of his songs in a series of essays. Robeson's signature performances include Showboat and Othello, but spirituals defined his early career. We now look at some highlights for Monday, March 30th. And there are just two, both on Radio 4. At 3pm is the final round of Round Britain Quiz, in which the north of England take on Wales. Tom Sutcliffe asks the questions, repeated on Saturday, April 4th at 11pm. Then at 4pm comes The City That Sings. Nombasa Makuko tells the story of the 2020 Masekule choir event in Makanda, South Africa, revealing how singing creates a brief diversion from the city's problems. On to March 31st, Tuesday, March 31st, at 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4 is My Life After Grenfell. Three survivors of the Grenfell Tower fire recount the hardships they've endured since that dreadful night of June the 14th, 2017. Then at 2:15 p.m, today's drama on Radio 4 is Settlers, a sci-fi comedy by Adam Uzdem, starring Laura Aikman and Tom Rosenthal as scientists who emerge from cryogenic freezing, expecting to find themselves in an habitable new world. But what follows is a bittersweet tale. At 8:40 p.m. on Radio 4 is In Touch with Peter White, with news and information for the blind and partially sighted. Followed at 9 p.m. on Radio 4 by Inside Health, a special episode on the coronavirus pandemic. Repeated Wednesday, April 1st, the next day, at 3:30 p.m. Finally, for Tuesday, March 31st, jazz fans will be keen to tune in to Jamie Cullum in his regular slot each week at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. It includes interviews, up-and-coming acts, and live performances. We now come to Wednesday, April 1st. This is No Fool's Day. And a new programme on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. is How to Play. This first episode features the brilliant young cellist who played at Harry and Meghan's wedding, Sheku Kana Mason, as he rehearses Elgar's autumnal cello concerto with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra as they prepare to perform at last year's BBC Proms. Then at 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4 is the return of Plum House, the comedy that follows the fortunes of the staff at a country house museum. Stars Simon Callow as the grandly idle curator, Miles Jupp as his ineffectual sidekick, and Jane Horrocks as the dozy gift shop manager. The drama on Radio 4 is at 2:15 p.m. with My Little Eye. Bob Trench is charged by the Prime Minister to track down and confront a bitter former soldier who served in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. Finally, for Wednesday, April 1st, and back to the coronavirus, is Fallout on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. Marianne Seagart and guests discuss the impact that COVID-19 could have on the role and image of the state. On to Thursday, April 2nd, and a new series. At 3 p.m. on Radio 4, Open Country returns. However, limited in her movements because of the coronavirus pandemic, Olympic rowing champion Helen Glover finds Open Country in her own back garden in Berkshire, where she's joined by her naturalist husband, Steve Backshall. It's repeated on Saturday, April 4th. At just after 6 a.m. Then over to Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. for Radio 3 in Concert and the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra performing works by Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite No. 1, Sibelius's Symphony No. 4, and Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 3 in C minor. Another new series on Radio 4 is In Business at 8:30 p.m. Ruth Alexander asks if the coronavirus pandemic is likely to have a long-term impact on global supply chains. It's repeated Sunday, April 5th at 9:30 p.m. And finally, we come to Friday, April 3rd. The afternoon drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is Eavesdropper, in which highly successful secret agent Claire is charged with the surveillance of potential terrorists. On one mission, she's fitted with a new hearing device and soon finds her hearing becoming so vivid that she's increasingly aware of unusual sounds. At 8 p.m. on Radio 4, you may want to tune into Any Questions. It's sure to cover many of the issues related to the coronavirus as its audience canvasses the opinions of four leading figures. Repeated on Saturday, April 4th at 1:10 p.m. Then why not end the week with Classic FM's Smooth Classics at 9 p.m, fronted by Margarita Taylor and Mylene Klass. 3 hours of soothing music could be just what we all need right now. Happy listening.
We now have the next in our series of Me and My Job interviews. Rob Pearman talks to local book publisher Claire Quinlivan.
Claire Quinlivan is publishing manager at Oldcastle Books, and there are various imprints under that title that we'll come back to later. Now, this is probably the only publishing house in this district, certainly as far as I know, and it's in Harpenden. We'd have to go further outside the area to get to another publishing house, so that's quite interesting, and that's why she's here. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to come back to the publishing house itself, because that's really what I want to explore and how you get into publishing and what goes on inside there. But I want to know a little bit more about you first, because like many people, you went to school and then you went to university and you at that point had to decide which way you were going to go. Did you have any idea right from early days that you wanted to go into publishing?
No, I didn't, not at all. Most people in publishing would probably tell you that they love reading, and that's why I decided to study English and French at university. And then it was between my year abroad and my final year that I was really thinking hard about what to do next, and I ended up luckily getting an internship at an independent publishing house based in London called Atlantic Books, and loved that. It was for a month. So at that point, before starting my final year of uni, I knew that I wanted to get into publishing. And then it just happened that this wonderful local publisher, I live in Hemel Hempstead, so it's not far, happened to be on my doorstep, and I got a 1 month internship with them, which started the week after I finished university. And that was 5.5 years ago. So I've kind of just stayed and taken on more responsibility.
Because there's quite a lot of responsibilities that you have, because as with any small organisation, you've got to be able to do 12 different things. I just want to come back to the internship, because there's been a lot of argument elsewhere, and not least in Parliament, about internships, and they're basically not paid. Are you not?
Your expenses are paid. Some publishing houses, the bigger ones mainly, now do paid internships, and that's really good. But most smaller ones still don't pay. And it's sort of a quid pro quo. We feel like we're really giving people very good experience. They really enjoy these internships, and it is the way into the industry. And there are many arguments about it, but being a small organisation ourselves, we can't always afford to pay for internships.
But for you, it worked.
It was absolutely brilliant. Neither of my internships were paid, but I learned so much from them, made really good contacts. It's definitely the way into publishing, and I'd recommend anyone wanting to get into the industry, that's what you aim for first.
Because my guess is it's an industry that quite a lot of people would like to get into. There's a sort of certain romance about it. We all like reading, we all like books, we all want to be novelists.
It's true, but I think it's an industry that people don't really know much about. It's quite opaque. People go into bookshops, they don't necessarily know all of the various things that are going on in the background to make that book happen. I certainly didn't know all the different departments that exist. I know we get a lot of interns who are really surprised to see all the various things that are going on. It's really competitive to get into the industry. It is popular in that sense, but there's a lot more to it, I think, than people see. Mainly interns come and they want to be editors, and that's quite common, and that's probably the most visible element of publishing. But there's rights, there's sales, there's design, there's production. There are loads of different parts to it, and they all contribute to a book.
Now, in your case, you've gone into a small publisher, but it actually has a number of half a dozen or more imprints and produces quite a variety of publications. Did you think when you got there that you knew exactly what you wanted to do? I mean, what was the job that you were invited to take up?
The internship was just, I was told when I interviewed for that, that I'd learn a little bit about everything. And that's, I probably enjoy everything so much. That's how I've ended up taking on such a range of responsibilities. I suppose I started out knowing most about editorial and thinking, oh, I want to read manuscripts and decide which ones go into publication. And I do some of that now.
And do you get a huge pile of books that are
all digital these days? Occasionally we get a printed manuscript through the post, but that's quite rare. It's quite fun, actually, quite exciting when you see one come through. But usually it's all digital, either from agents or direct from authors.
Most publishers aren't interested in authors contacting them.
It depends between publishing houses. Most just say agents only. We do accept both, especially for one of our lists, which is a digital first list. We accept unagented manuscripts for that, because you can often find hidden gems in amongst those.
I want to come back to what you mean by digital first in a moment, but just to keep on you and your jobs, because looking at the list, your official title is publishing manager, which seems to be covers all sins. What does that mean? What do you do?
The title is supposed to be broad, to encompass sort of the variety of things. So I do editorial. So in that sense, I read submissions, and if I like them, I make a proposal as to why we should acquire them. And then that's really a project manager role. So I'll take the book from manuscript right the way through to publication, liaise with all my other colleagues about what the cover design should look like and what the blurb should be. I also do rights, so I sell our audio rights, which are called sub-licenses. So we sell the rights on to a audio-specific publisher.
So you don't produce the audio. You've got the digital printed copy, and that's going to be recorded by somebody else.
Exactly, yeah. Some bigger publishing houses are starting to do that in-house, produce their audiobooks more and more, but we sell those rights on. I do marketing, so that's Facebook advertising, and a lot to do with our social media feeds, monitoring those with the help of our publicity colleagues and interns, really helping that, the social media side of things. There's royalties, which is how authors get paid, which I do a lot of work to import our sales for that into our database.
Now, if an author has an agent, the agent will be looking after some of that.
But we would have to report to the agent, then the agent takes their percentage and reports to the author.
Authors are sensitive people, aren't they? They need to be handled gently.
And they're really great people to work with, but with any sort of client management, they are your client and you're trying to do a good job for them. You have to be good at people management to work in the industry and good at communication and making sure everybody's on the same page, and managing expectations is a key one, because obviously not everybody is going to be a bestseller. You know, you can't all be. So managing expectations is a really key skill that I've certainly developed, communicating with different types of personalities.
Some writers will be very withdrawn, some will be very aggressive or dynamic.
And these days in publishing, really, authors do a lot of self-promotion as well, having their social media channels. So having authors who are happy to do that sort of self-promotion is really good and helpful for us.
One of the things I've never understood is when an author, a very well-known author, would get a huge advance, I can't work out how they can ever pay that back in numbers of books sold.
Our advances aren't as huge as they would be in big publishing houses, and I think a lot of the time they don't necessarily earn out, but there is a lot that goes into calculating how much you're willing to put forward as an advance. So you project what you think the sales figures would be, the sales team are involved in whether you pitch for the book at all and what the limit would be. So there's a lot that goes on to forecast and make sure you're not over committing. But there are books that never earn out their advances, and that's just the way it goes, because you can't really predict what's going to work until it's out there and you see what happens. Sometimes you can be surprised that something will be a real success. Other times you'll think this book is just going to be amazing and do so well, and it just doesn't hit the mark or find its audience. That's just how it goes sometimes.
There must be elements of luck. I mean,
yeah,
you get the
definitely.
Right review and you're away.
Exactly, yeah.
You're publishing books. It is the traditional way, but as you said, a lot of your books become audiobooks.
Yes.
And that's a growing market, isn't it?
Yes, really growing at the moment. Lots of young people turning to audiobooks, actually, and I think it's as we feel busier. I love audiobooks, and that's because I can listen to them in the car and when I'm commuting. I love non-fiction audio, but also fiction, but I can learn something or expand my mind while I'm doing something else. So I think that's one of the reasons that audio is becoming more popular, because you can do it while you're doing something else. It's definitely a growing market.
And the statistics show that.
Yeah.
Okay. But then also, some of your books, do they move from what was intended to be a traditional print medium into a digital medium? Or
all of our books are published in ebook and print form now. Traditionally it was always in print, but now it will be simultaneous print and ebook. Sometimes ebook beforehand, which is where digital first comes in. Now we just always make them available in both formats.
And so digital first means
ebook first, yes. Generally that's for our Verve list, which is a new list that we've set up, and that's commercial sort of page turning crime fiction and normal fiction. And that is where we'll publish an ebook. And then if we see that there's a lot of interest or that the book has been well received, we'll then publish in print, but we won't necessarily guarantee that the book will be in print at the beginning. The costs of making an ebook are a lot less than the cost of making a print book.
You helped to found this digital first list, which is called Verve Books.
Yes.
So that's the newest imprint.
That's right.
Digital imprint. We've got Oldcastle Books.
That's the main company in the original list.
No Exit Press is the crime.
It's crime, thrillers, espionage, historical fiction. That's probably the imprint that we're best known for.
And you've got some sort of more specialist areas, like you, mm-hmm. you call one imprint Creative Essentials, which I looked at. This is like how to write a screenplay.
Exactly,
how to
yeah.
Things. I didn't quite grasp one of them, which was the pulp, the classics.
They're reissues of classics. So you've got The Great Gatsby and Romeo and Juliet, and they're just with pulp covers. The text hasn't changed. It's just a new look to them. And they were painted by someone who works for our sales team. We haven't done any new ones in a few years now, but when they first came out, they were very popular. The trouble with those is that you can get a lot of the classics for free now, so it's a hard market to make books.
Do you think your company will add more imprints?
I don't think so. We're only a small team. There's only so much that we can do. But if we get a new idea that doesn't fit into one of our imprints, then that's usually a sign that we'll start a new one.
Publishing must be very satisfying in the sense that it's nice because you're enjoying the words, you're enjoying the print, but of course you've got to sell it.
Which is obviously the most challenging part of it, especially now with ebooks as well, which have been brilliant in certain terms. And we've certainly done really well from them, especially on the No Exit, where probably 70% of our books are on the no exit list. Those books sell really well as ebooks. But the flip side of that is that there are so many more books now. Just also the speed with which you can publish books now, the competition is a lot heavier now. So
does that mean that writers get less?
They still get the same per sale, but there's just a lot more competition for sales. Visibility is harder. That's where our publicity team come in really well. And we've got a brilliant freelance publicist who works with us at the minute. And getting your book noticed through publicity is really crucial for visibility and then for sales. Yeah. When I say publicity, really what I mean is getting reviews. So pitching to the media and then hoping a journalist will take the book and review it. And we've got good connections with a lot of the national media, and we do get reviewed regularly, and that has a really positive impact.
Are there prizes that you enter for?
There's an organisation called the Crime Writers Association, and they offer prizes for our genre specifically, and we've won a few of those in the years gone by. We won 2 1 year for a book called Dodgers by Bill Beverley. That also won the British Book Award for Best Crime Thriller. And then as a publishing house, this year we won the Best Crime and Mystery Publisher of the Year. Prizes definitely help with the book's visibility, and then for us as well, it's nice to have that recognition. And
so you're talking about reviews, that's very important, but you have to get it in front of a lot of different people.
Well, you have to get it into the bookshop first, which is also difficult because there's obviously lots of publishing houses trying to get into bookshops, and the number of bookshops out there has shrunk, and the range is shrinking as well.
People like me walk into Waterstones and we assume, well, that's the range that there is.
It's not at all. The buyers pick and they take a certain quantity, and they could put 10 copies of a book in one of our local bookshops, but then there'll be none in the northeast of that book, or there could be one copy of a book in every store around the country, but there's only one copy, so would a buyer notice it? Really, reviews are the main driver of people then knowing to look for the book. Also, the presence on social media. Radio is really good for us. If we can get our author onto a radio station, that really helps. Having a good cover design is crucial for both digital and print books, because the deciding factor for someone if they want to buy a book or not is whether they get drawn to it on the shelf. There's a lot of factors that contribute. And then there's also rights sales, which, as well as selling audio rights, there's translation rights. So we use a sub-agent for that, so she sells the rights on our behalf. That is another way for authors to earn income, because they get a percentage of whatever the book sells for in translation. So if you sell French rights, for example, they'll get a cut of what was made from that deal. Obviously, if a book sells really well here, then it's likely that it got something that is going to appeal to global audiences. But it doesn't always work. Books don't always translate. But usually when you sub-license rights, translation rights, then it's up to that publisher. They have to launch it in their own territory.
It's quite a tricky business, isn't it?
A lot of challenges to overcome, but there's a lot of positives as well.
What role does social media play in promoting?
First of all, it's great for connecting directly with readers. So authors can speak instantly with someone who's read and loved and reviewed their book. So it's the conversation that it generates. It's really the first point at which we get a sense of how people are reacting to a book. So we've just sent out proof copies, which are advanced copies of a book that we've got coming out next May called When We Fall. It's a brilliant book, and the book has just landed around the country, so bloggers and booksellers and other authors are starting to read it and give us feedback, and the feedback so far has been really positive, so you get a sense that that book is hopefully going to do really well.
Is that why you've done it? Because you want the feedback, or do you want them to start talking about it?
Well, both. We want the feedback. We're hoping for early reviews, which we can then put on the next edition of the book, but we're also wanting to start a conversation about it and people hopefully recommending it, because word of mouth is obviously a really key way of increasing sales. The books that have done really well are the ones that you see people recommending online a lot.
Is there a lot of teamwork that goes on? A lot of you sitting around with different skills and different activities that have to come together to plan things?
Yeah, there's a lot of collaboration. So obviously being in a small team, even more so, there's our MD who runs the whole business, and he's the founder and publisher. He set up the business over 30 years ago now. And then we've got production director, and she really makes sure that the book gets printed and gets made into an ebook.
That's the actual sort of physical production side,
yeah,
in terms of
right.
print or media.
And typesetting, so making the PDF, which will then go to the printer. She also actually does a lot of editorial work, so she liaises with proofreaders and copy editors and with ebook designers, and just making sure that that manuscript can be put on sale. Cover designers as well, she liaises a lot with those. There is a lot of collaboration. We all have to be on the same page with what we're going to do for certain titles, where we're putting resources. In a bigger publishing house, I mean, I've never worked in one, but my understanding is that the departments are much more separated, and they do have weekly meetings where everybody comes together, but might not be the same sort of collaboration where we have, where every day we sit just a room apart from each other. I really like that element of it. Everyone's hands-on all the time, working towards the same goals.
Is it possible to say how many books you publish in an average year?
About 30 to 40 new books. We regularly reprint as well and reissue books that might have gone out of print, but probably around 30 to 40 new books.
And you convert older ones into ebooks?
Most of our backlist is now converted into ebook. That was quite a big project, but most of it's available because why not make it available in different format?
Well, you obviously enjoy it.
I'd recommend it as an industry to get into, certainly. It's a good way of combining creativity and business skills, I think. It's a really good industry for that. You have to be switched on in terms of what's going to sell, but also you have a bit of freedom to be inspired and take an idea for something and run with it. Certainly in a smaller publishing house, that's really nice that you have that freedom, and the managers put the trust in me that I can actually choose a book, if I like it, to publish.
Thank you very much, Claire.
You're welcome.
Now we have our piece of music, Running Water's Full by Gothby, in its entirety. And finally, a new feature. Here are some well-known people whose birthdays fall this week. On the 29th of March 1943, John Major, British Prime Minister from 1990 to 97, was born in Carshalton, Surrey. On the 30th of March 1820, Anna Sewell, author of Black Beauty, was born in Great Yarmouth, Norfolk. On the 31st of March 1685, Johann Sebastian Bach, the composer, was born in Eisenach in the Duchy of Sachse-Eisenach, now part of Germany. On the 1st of April 1957, David Gower, cricketer and bon viveur, was born in Tunbridge Wells, Kent. On the 2nd of April 1805, Hans Christian Andersen, the author, was born in Odense, in Denmark. He wrote novels, plays and poems, but he is of course most famous for his fairy tales, of which he wrote a staggering 3,381. On the 3rd of April 1922, Doris Day, the actress whose real name was Doris Kappelhoff, was born in Cincinnati, Ohio. On the 4th of April 1928, Maya Angelou, U.S. author of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and many others, was born in St. Louis, Missouri. And now a selection of notable events that occurred this week in former years. On the 29th of March 1974, Chinese farmers discovered the buried terracotta army of 8,000 warrior statues. On the 30th of March 1867, the U.S. bought Alaska from Imperial Russia for $7.2 million, or about 2 cents per acre. Sounds like a bargain. On the 31st of March 1657, Parliament offered Oliver Cromwell the crown, which he declined. Thank goodness. On the 1st of April 1748, the ruins of Pompeii were rediscovered by the Spanish military engineer Roque Joaquín de Alcubierre. On the 2nd of April 1801, the Royal Navy, led by Horatio Nelson, destroyed the Danish fleet in the Battle of Copenhagen. On the 3rd of April 1043, Edward the Confessor was crowned King of England. And on the 4th of April 1968, the US civil rights activist Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. And that completes this programme. Many thanks to Wendy for reading with me today, to Angela who provided the radio listings, and to John who read them. And of course, we'll be back again next month. But that's all from News Extra in March 2020. Goodbye.